Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Gaslight, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline and the Fight for America's Energy Future. By Jonathan Mingle. Narrated by Daniel Henning. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. Frederick Douglass. A note to the listener. Whoever gave it the name natural gas, now there was a marketing coup. Cheryl LaFleur, former chairman of the obscure but powerful Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, had a point. The world's fastest growing fossil fuel has some built-in branding advantages. Consider a lump of coal. Chances are you picture a crumbly, carbonaceous rock that leaves everything it touches smudged, smoky, smeared. Now consider the words natural gas. The first thing that comes to mind might be a neat blue flame dancing on your stovetop or in the pages of a kitchen design catalog. In surveys, when Americans are asked what they associate with the words natural gas, most mention words like clean and energy. It's worth taking a moment to ponder why that's the case. Natural gas just sounds so natural, LaFleur noted. And who doesn't like natural? But natural gas is the sibling of coal and oil, derived from the same raw materials, long-dead organisms trapped deep underground. Natural gas is a fossil fuel extracted with chemicals and heavy machinery, refined and compressed, and pumped across thousands of miles to be burned in basement furnaces and kitchen stoves and power plants, producing an array of pollutants from nitrogen oxides to volatile organic compounds to carbon dioxide. So it's fair to wonder, like Cheryl LaFleur, just how this other carbon-rich substance acquired its label. It turns out that the term was coined in the early 19th century to differentiate gas that occurred naturally, that is, seeping out of the ground, from town gas, which was manufactured from coal in a rather nasty process in urban factories. This era also gave rise to the first generation of gas utilities. Gas light companies spread from Norfolk to Atlanta, New York to Baltimore, supplying manufactured gas and later natural gas to city street lamps. Before long, they veined their way into America's businesses and homes, more than 75 million at last count. One consequence of this inherited terminology is that today, relatively few people think about exactly what they're burning when they turn on their stove. Years ago, I had some people in my office talking about methane leaks, said LaFleur, whose former job involved weighing the merits of some of America's most consequential energy projects. These were people from well-known, respected environmental groups. One of them asked if she knew that natural gas emits methane. I said, I'm pretty sure natural gas is methane. She was right on that score, too. But when asked how they feel about methane or methane gas, Americans of all political persuasions report much more negative feelings. Their strongest associations? Global warming, greenhouse, and climate change. Methane is emitted from a variety of human and natural sources, from fossil fuel production to agriculture to wetlands. In this book, natural gas and methane and gas and fossil gas will all be deployed to refer to the same substance, the colorless, odorless gas with the chemical formula CH4 that is lighter than air, easy to ignite, and traded as one of the world's most prized commodities. These words are used interchangeably, partly for convenience and partly to illustrate how words can serve to clarify or cloud what we're really talking about when we talk about natural gas. Prologue. The People versus the Pipeline. Nancy Sorrells sat down in the gallery of the Supreme Court of the United States, looked around the storied chamber, and took a moment to marvel at just how far she and her neighbors had come. It was February 24th, 2020. Nearly 6 years had passed since Dominion Energy, one of the biggest power companies in the country, had unveiled its plans to build a natural gas pipeline from West Virginia's fracking fields across Virginia to eastern North Carolina. At 42 inches in diameter, the pipeline would be the largest to ever cross Appalachia's rock-ribbed ridges. At close to 600 miles in length, it would be nearly as long as the Blue Ridge Mountains themselves. And with a price tag that had swelled to $8 billion, its owners would have a strong incentive to keep gas flowing through it for decades to come. Sorrells, a publisher and historian who lived in a Shenandoah Valley hamlet a few miles from the project's path, helped lead one of the dozens of grassroots groups that had banded together to fight it since 2014. She and a small contingent had traveled to Washington, D.C. the night before with plans to rise at 3 a.m. and wait for tickets to hear oral arguments in their case, Atlantic Coast Pipeline LLC and U.S. Forest Service versus Cowpasture River Preservation Association. But they discovered a long line of people already winding around First Street and East Capitol, angling to be among the 50 members of the public admitted. Throughout the night, fellow pipeline fighters from Virginia and West Virginia clustered together in small groups, chatting, sharing thermoses of tea, stamping their feet in the darkness. When Dominion routed its pipeline through their communities, the company had roused and unified a diverse group of citizens from across the political spectrum in opposition. Retirees, innkeepers, farmers, scientists, physical therapists, pastors, nurses, teachers, builders, former lobbyists, engineers, and entrepreneurs. With temperatures hovering just above freezing, some wrapped themselves in sleeping bags and reclined on folding chairs to grab brief snatches of sleep. A member of Sorrell's group stayed in line while the rest retired for the night. At 5 a.m., having secured just one ticket between them, the group decided that Sorrell's should be the one to use it. After all, few had been more relentless in the struggle against Dominion's pipeline, or more confident that they could defeat it. For years, Sorrells had been telling everyone that the Atlantic Coast Pipeline was not inevitable, that if they kept fighting, their band of Davids would overcome Dominion's Goliath. In every email she sent, every flyer she handed out, she included the sentence, "This pipeline is not a done deal." And here, she thought, was the proof. Nearly everyone had expected Dominion, the most politically powerful company in Virginia, to steamroll them. "At the very beginning, it was like we were just a little drop in the ocean," she said. But after years of contending in courtrooms, street protests, shareholders' meetings, newspaper opinion pages, and under the fluorescent lights at every conceivable kind of county or state or federal public hearing, they had stymied the largest fossil fuel pipeline project to come out of Appalachia. And they had forced Dominion to appeal to the highest court in the land for permission to build its gas line through Virginia's mountains. Once the justices had taken their seats, Sorrell's first thought was, "There's Ruth Bader Ginsburg. This is unreal." But as she listened to the oral arguments unfold, her excitement was tempered by a dawning realization. They were going to lose this case. Many of the grassroots groups opposing Dominion's pipeline were represented by the Southern Environmental Law Center, a nonprofit legal organization based in Charlottesville. As was common practice, SELC had hired a veteran counsel with experience before the Supreme Court to argue the case. As he jostled with the justices, Sorrells kept jotting down notes and thinking of points she wished he would make. "It wasn't a bad argument," she said, "but he didn't make those points because he hadn't lived it for 6 years." From her home at the western foot of the Blue Ridge, a few miles from where Dominion planned to drive a mile-long tunnel through the mountains, Sorrells had been living it since the day it was announced. In the fall of 2014, Dominion had mailed a flyer to residents of communities along the project's proposed route through Western Virginia. Like a coach collecting opponents' taunts on the locker room bulletin board to motivate her players, Sorrells had held on to it ever since. Printed in large font against a backdrop of forested mountains and lush valleys stretching west of the Blue Ridge was a bold claim. The Atlantic Coast Pipeline will change everything and nothing. This slogan encapsulated Dominion's sales pitch. Its gas conduit would supercharge collective prosperity at virtually no cost. The company sought to convince everyone, local landowners, lawmakers, investors, regulators, that the ACP was essential to meet growing demand for gas, lower energy bills for its customers, and cut its own carbon emissions as it replaced older coal-burning power plants. And moreover, that it could safely bury its pipe across the region's steep, slide-prone slopes. But for many who lived in its path, that tagline offered an inverted reflection of their darkest fears. They feared that, in terms of concrete economic benefits, the pipeline would change nothing. Local businesses wouldn't be able to tap its gas even if they wanted to, unless they paid a $5.5 million connection fee. Construction jobs would be temporary, largely filled by crews from Oklahoma and Texas. Many local residents got their power from local cooperatives, not Dominion. And on the other side, they worried the project really would change everything. That it would threaten life and limb, water quality, property values, local businesses, ecosystems, the very stability of their beloved mountains themselves, and their children's ability to live safely among them. They worried about dwelling within the blast radius of a potential rupture and explosion, and many feared the climate consequences of a fossil fuel project with an 80-year lifespan. "The pipeline will be virtually invisible," Dominion's flyer promised. "There are 2.5 times more miles of underground natural gas pipelines than interstate highways in Virginia, yet few people ever notice." Yet few people ever notice. Those five words were, in retrospect, an inadvertent Rosetta Stone for understanding the gambit of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline and the broader narrative driving the gas-building boom that had engulfed America for more than a decade. Dominion was just one of many energy companies making big bets on gas. The success of those investments depended on convincing people that there were few, if any, costs or risks worth paying any mind. That line was intended to soothe locals' anxieties, to suggest that after construction crews packed up and left, all they would see was a grassy strip that resembled a golf course fairway. But it could also be read as an admission that if you looked closely enough, maybe there was something to see. Cause for concern rather than comfort going on down there. Nancy Sorrells, for instance, knew that beneath the flyer's veranda vista, where Dominion planned to string its pipe, was a vast network of limestone caves, sinkholes, and underground rivers connected to downstream drinking water supplies around the region, from Washington to Richmond. And in fact, from Pennsylvania to Virginia, people already in the fracking and pipeline boom's crosshairs had been noticing for years. It was hard to ignore a massive trench being dug in your yard or farm or community and giant pipes laid in it. And once you saw that messy process up close, it was hard not to wonder about some of the other less obvious consequences, and about the strength of the industry's broader case for building more gas infrastructure. According to Dominion and many other energy companies, the argument for natural gas was a slam dunk. As the flyer noted, burning gas to generate electricity produced half the carbon emissions of burning coal. This talking point undergirded the familiar claim that gas was a bridge fuel to a cleaner, climate-safe future. A metaphor repeated so often in news stories and politicians' stump speeches and CEOs' conference keynotes that it had hardened into orthodoxy. It was indeed a fact that gas power plants produced less carbon dioxide than coal plants. But those selling the bridge needed people to not notice some other facts. For instance, that the metaphor was floated by the gas industry itself way back in 1988 as climate change first burst into public consciousness, helpfully proffering their product as the least harmful alternative while the world looks for other, longer-lasting solutions to the greenhouse effect. And secondly, that we all seem to be stuck on their bridge with no end in sight. Bridges, of course, are meant to deliver you somewhere else. 3 decades later, gas had dethroned coal as the leading source of power. America had become the world's top producer and exporter of natural gas. Meanwhile, in the period between 1988 and 2020, humans had added more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere than in all of human history up to that point. Yet the industry continued to tout gas as the only sure route to a greener future. Exhibit A, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, perhaps the most ambitious project yet. By 2020, plenty of people had long since taken notice of some other salient facts, too. Investing finite capital into gas meant fewer dollars available for renewables and a slower transition to clean energy. Building more gas infrastructure risked locking in decades of future carbon dioxide emissions. Gas wasn't the only alternative to coal. Wind, solar, batteries, and energy efficiency were readily available and getting cheaper by the month. The 6 years since Dominion had launched its pipeline had been the 6 hottest years since record-keeping began. And more gas meant more emissions of a climate-warming superpollutant. Because natural gas, you see, is methane. And methane is a greenhouse gas that packs 86 times the heat-trapping power as carbon dioxide over a 20-year period. Some scientists have called it carbon dioxide on steroids. Methane is responsible for a third of the global temperature rise since pre-industrial times. Since 2007, methane levels in the atmosphere had surged at twice the rate of carbon dioxide concentrations. Alarmed by this spike, climate scientists warned that unless methane emissions were wrestled downward, the world's efforts to keep global warming under 2 degrees would fail. That would push us past tipping points from which there might be no returning, rendering unrecognizable the friendly climate that humans have evolved with, an outcome that really would change everything. Dominion's project, if built, would play no small role in bringing about that reality. Because, like all gas pipelines, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline would be a very large and long-lived methane delivery device. Picture an enormous 42-inch-wide interstate-scale cigarette lighter that keeps working for a century. At one end, the fracking wells of the Marcellus Shale. At the other, dozens of gas power plants and hundreds of thousands of burner tips in furnaces, water heaters, and kitchen stoves. In between, a vast metallic spaghetti of gas field gathering lines and large diameter pipelines and local distribution lines. On its journey through all those pipes and valves and fittings, as any plumber could tell you, some methane would inevitably escape. If all the gas in the Marcellus Shale were to be exploited, methane leaks alone would likely equal 3 times the total annual carbon dioxide emissions of the United States, making the Marcellus the largest methane bomb in the world, according to researchers. The methane that did make it to the end of the pipe would feed machines designed to convert that gas into carbon dioxide, the primary driver of climate change. Simple facts derived from the laws of physics. But physics has a hard time competing with public relations. The word methane did not appear on Dominion's flyer, nor was it uttered in the chambers of the Supreme Court. As Nancy Sorrells listened, the oral arguments were starting to sound like a sophomore philosophy class. The justices seemed more interested in the metaphysics of trails than the physics of gas pipes. At issue was whether the law allowed Dominion to build its pipeline at Reed's Gap, its chosen spot for crossing the Blue Ridge, where the Appalachian Trail ran through the national forest land. The government's lawyer, defending the Forest Service, repeated his core argument, which aligned with that of Dominion's lawyers, that the company could bore underneath the iconic footpath because the trail is not land. This idea didn't sit well with Justice Elena Kagan. "Nobody makes this distinction in real life," she countered. A slightly surreal debate over the nature of a trail ensued, with musings from Justices Samuel Alito and Stephen Breyer. Is a trail inseparable from the land that it traverses? Is it something that lies on top of the ground but separate from it, like a ribbon? Does it go to the center of the earth? Then Chief Justice John Roberts chimed in and unintentionally cut to the heart of the matter. If the court ruled against Dominion, he worried aloud, would it erect an impermeable barrier to any pipeline from the area where the natural gas, those resources are located, and to the area east of it where there's more of a need for them? In other words, would the Appalachian Trail become a wall preventing energy companies from tapping the vast fossil fuel reserves lying underneath Appalachia? As he listened, Greg Buport's thoughts paralleled those of his client, Nancy Sorrells, sitting a few dozen feet away. The odds, he had to admit, were not looking good. Roberts wasn't the only justice peppering his lead counsel with skeptical questions. Buport, a senior attorney for the Southern Environmental Law Center, had started scrutinizing Dominion's proposed pipeline and its risks to the region's water, air, climate, citizens, and economy in the summer of 2014. At the time, Dominion had confidently predicted that the pipeline would be finished with 1.5 billion cubic feet of gas flowing through it each day by the end of 2018. But here it was, the winter of 2020, and not a single piece of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline had been laid in Virginia's soil. The project was at least 3 years behind schedule. Construction had been mostly halted since late 2018, thanks to a series of successful legal challenges mounted by SELC, their grassroots clients, and partner organizations in the region. Buport was a seasoned environmental attorney, but at the outset he knew little about the 1938 Natural Gas Act or interstate pipelines. Over the past 6 years, he liked to joke, he had acquired an inadvertent PhD in both subjects. And to his now expertly trained ear, most of the justices seemed inclined to side with Dominion. Buport and his colleagues, led by D.J. Gerken, SELC's lead litigator on the case since 2018, had argued that because the Appalachian Trail was administered as a unit of the National Park System, Dominion would need special authorization from Congress to cross it at Reed's Gap. A federal appellate court had agreed, citing a 100-year-old federal law that prohibited drilling or pipelines on national park lands. Dominion had appealed, and now the justices would determine whether it needed that act of Congress to greenlight its plan, a time-consuming and uncertain prospect. The legal questions were narrow and technical, winding through a thicket of competing interpretations of obscure statutes. But for a moment, the Chief Justice had gestured toward the much wider stakes of the morning's debate. The premise embedded in Roberts' question was that America would need more methane gas and more pipelines to transport it for many years to come. This conviction was widely shared beyond the conservative-leaning Supreme Court. Support for the natural gas construction frenzy underway across the country had become a fixed feature of the landscape of bipartisan elite opinion. But that very premise, that building the Atlantic Coast Pipeline was good for America, that there was a need for its gas that outweighed all the risks it posed to the region's people, forests, climate, and economy, was the delusion that Greg Buport and his colleagues had spent years trying to dispel. With the patience of a master builder, he had painstakingly assembled a case, still waiting to be heard by another federal appeals court, that challenged Dominion's rationale for the project and the methodology the federal government used to determine whether a gas pipeline was, in its arcane phrasing, in the public convenience and necessity. In his view, that case was the main event. But no one was writing headlines about it. Instead, all eyes, Wall Street, the gas and utility industries, energy analysts, and environmental advocates, were trained on the Supreme Court. As the oral arguments wrapped up, Buppert still had reasons to be heartened. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had noted that the case before them addressed only one of four fatal flaws that the appeals court found in the Forest Service permit. Wouldn't this question about who could authorize crossing the Appalachian Trail be moot, she wondered, if federal courts ruled the pipeline couldn't proceed due to those various other shortcomings? Until the Forest Service fixed them all, APC LLC would still lack permission to cross the national forests. And even if those problems were resolved, Dominion would still lack seven other critical permits, several of which the SELC and its allies had already successfully challenged. If they lost this high-profile battle, if, as media outlets were already speculating, a Supreme Court win for Dominion breathed new life into their embattled pipeline, Nancy Sorrells and her fellow activists were determined to press on. The larger war was still up for grabs, and the stakes were high. They were fighting for their homes, their neighbors, their children's futures. The six-year-long fight, longer than the Civil War, that had converged on this contested spot atop the Blue Ridge Mountains, was also a struggle to shape the trajectory of the U.S. energy system for decades to come. Dominion and other energy companies wanted Sorrells, and indeed all Americans, to see projects like the Atlantic Coast Pipeline as a bridge to a better world, to a clean energy future. But when they looked closely, many saw something that looked more like a fuse, with a blast radius that enveloped and extended far beyond their beloved Virginia Hills. Part 1. The Public Necessity. Chapter 1. The Burning Spring. On March 9, 1669, John Lederer walked west out of Jamestown in the company of three native guides. The German physician and explorer had been tasked by Virginia's colonial governor with finding promising routes through the distant mountains to boost the fur trade and perhaps establish a western passage to California and its fabled Spanish mines of silver and copper, rumored to be just a few weeks' march away. On the sixth day of their journey, Lederer's party crested a hill about a dozen miles northeast of what is now Charlottesville and glimpsed the mountains to the west. At this sight, Lederer's companions prostrated themselves and prayed, crying out in reverence for the mountains. God is nigh! After four more days of walking, past great herds of red and fallow deer and bears crashing massed like swine, and a difficult climb, Lederer became the first European to set foot atop the Blue Ridge and see the Allegheny Highlands beyond. The view filled him with awe and disappointment. Mountains stretched westward as far as he could see. Daunted by the thick tangle of trees and cliffs below, he returned to Jamestown. The following year, Lederer set out again with the same mission and a much larger contingent of 20 Englishmen and five native guides. They traveled to where the Rockfish River flows into the James at the southeast corner of what is today Nelson County, Virginia. A community of Monacan Indians who lived in a series of villages along the river greeted them. Lederer asked the locals for directions, as one does. An old man grabbed a stick and traced in the dirt two well-trod routes they could take. Lederer's English companions rebuffed this advice and insisted on pressing ahead in a straight westward line, dictated by their compass, heedless of obstacles in their way. This didn't sit well with Lederer, but he was outvoted. After a week of rough going over...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?